verse 1, Genesis chapter 11. Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Then they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, "Indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech." So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. Now we'll start kind of at the end just for a few key items. First of all, you understand this city was named after the fact. It was named Babel, literally means confusion. And because of the confusing of the languages, which is part of the story, after the city and the tower and all that project was abandoned and the people abandoned it and really began to scatter, from that point on it is called confusion. That was not the name they put over the city gates when they were building the walls. Welcome to Babel. This is a description after the fact. You understand that. You also have to understand that this story, back in chapter 9, ends the story of the great flood, the worldwide flood that destroyed all the flesh on the planet except for Noah and his immediate family and, of course, the animals that were with him in the ark that God had him build. Chapter 10 kind of gives genealogy and people groups and so forth. Sometimes it's called the Table of Nations, or the different people groups that descended from Noah's descendants and so forth. So it's right after this time of the flood. God had told them that he had wanted them to repopulate the earth. One of the tasks was, it goes back to really the original task, was fill the earth. God had given this wonderful planet for mankind to dwell on. He said, "Okay, you're starting small, just 8 people, and as they start having children and as the generations develop after them," he wanted them to scatter out and subdue and to really do what God wanted them to do originally. Now, it says that, verse 2, "They came to pass that they journeyed from the east, and they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there." Many of the Bible cities that we're going to look at, it's very, very exact where it was. In other words, if we were talking about Jericho, there is a city called Jericho there, and it's basically on the site of ancient Jericho. And archaeologists have dug up the remains of Jericho of old. We know kind of exactly where it was. The city of Babel, we don't know exactly, but we have a pretty good idea. You'll bring up the first slide there, Jeremy, just to get a little geographic background. You see the Mediterranean Sea, you see Egypt and so forth, and that's a very simplistic map, but it just gives you an idea. Mount Ararat is up in Turkey, in that area, where you see the star. And so that's where civilization begins to be reborn after the flood. Go ahead and bring up the next one, if you will. If you just kind of look down the Mesopotamian Valley, the Tigris and Euphrates Valley, somewhere in that area, in the area probably of modern-day Iraq and Kuwait, which we know from recent our history in our lifetimes, we know where those places are. Somewhere in that vast plain was where the Tower of Babel, the city of Babel, was located. We don't know exactly. One of the things that you understand from that place, there was not, and he talks about God in this description given through Moses, who penned these first 5 books of the Old Testament, including Genesis. It talks about they didn't have stone to build with. If you would think about Egypt of old, and you think about the pyramids that were built, they were built out of cut stone, quarried stone. There was no stone to quarry, so they developed a new technique to take mud and to bake these bricks and to, in essence, make quote-unquote artificial stone. And that's what was their main building material. That some of that obviously was used in Egypt, because you remember that was part of what the slaves of Moses' time were doing. But the ruins that are left, that we understand, were made of cut stone. So you had those two things that were taking place. It's interesting. Now, you can't go to a place and say, here's the ruins of the Tower of Babel, the city of Babel. But what you can find in modern-day Iraq and other places in that area of the world, you can find remains of structures that are very similar to what's described here. So apparently this was not the last tower of its type that was built. But God took particular exception and interferes with this one. Let me just show you a couple of pictures. You bring up the next slide. The top one is the remains of a tower that's in modern-day Iran. And if you think of the pyramids of Egypt, which we're very familiar with, at least what they look like, how they just have four slanted sides coming from a square base up to a pinnacle. The tower's remains in this part of the world were like one level, and then a smaller level, and a little smaller level, and a smaller level, and that way. They were called stepped pyramids or ziggurats. And there's several of them. There's one also in near Baghdad in Iraq, which is just kind of like the central core is left in some of the outlying area. The most famous one is what's called the Ziggurat of Ur. And if you see the top picture, it's in black and white because that's a very old picture of it. It was first kind of studied and excavated in the 1920s and 1930s, and that's what it looked like. It was ruined and it had some pieces falling off of it. In the 1980s, when Saddam Hussein was in power, he decided, and the archaeologists probably were all opposed to this because it damaged its actual remains. But Saddam Hussein billed himself as the second Nebuchadnezzar. And from what you know from our history, he had great delusions of grandeur and power, and he was going to destroy Israel and all those sorts of things. And as you well know from Scripture, God has other plans for Israel. But he decided to rebuild the Ziggurat of Ur. So what he did, if you see the lower two pictures, he built the outside and rebuilt it. So if you go there today, and a lot of times you can see pictures of soldiers that were in Iraq during and after the war, and that was a famous place. If you're in the area, go get your picture taken in front of this. So it's now been reconstructed on the original site. Some people think that he made statements, and he made contradictory statements, Saddam Hussein did, that he wanted to recreate the glory of Babylon of old. It's interesting that his megalomania and his delusions of grandeur sound strangely similar to what you read in this chapter in Genesis, of let's make some big name for ourselves. But also he wanted to be a nice tourist attraction. So that's why he went to build it. So there's the remains of this tower. So when you talk about the Tower of Babel, as best we can tell, it probably was in some sense on this pattern. One big square and then a smaller square, and to build this stepped pyramid or this tower. And it's interesting, even though we do not know that where this one that is described in the Bible, and probably all of its remains are long gone and buried under the sands there, we do know that this was a very common practice. So just a little bit of background for you. And now let's look at some things that we want to get from the text now. And we're going to do this in three fashions. We'll talk a little bit about the historical background of Babel from the text. We're going to talk about the spiritual lessons from Babel. And then we're going to learn about some life lessons that can help us. What can we pull out of the text to help us? And we've entitled this study this way. Babel, a city of unbridled ambition. They wanted to do what they wanted to do and didn't care what God said about it. You and I know very well that if we ever have that attitude, we are in for a rude awakening at some point. God does not tolerate this kind of an attitude. But understand, this attitude did not die out when Babel was confused in the languages and off they went. It still flows through humanity today, and let's be very honest. Even we who are followers of Christ, we still fight the tendency to want to go our own way. Isaiah 53 says it this way. It says, all we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned everyone to his what? His own way. Now, understand that's speaking of the unsaved person, but this side of heaven, when God finishes the process of completely changing us, we still fight that tendency. So there's some very good warnings for us here. Okay, let's just see if we can find the historical background from the text. We look at some of the background of the location and so forth just a moment, extra biblical. But as you study the text, it was, first of all, it was God's will was to populate the earth or to fill the earth. What got them in trouble was that as they, it says in verse 2, as it came to pass, as they journeyed, they are on the move, moving ever outward. It says they found a plain in this land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And rather than continue to expand the borders, they said, we're going to make with these bricks and bake them and so forth. Verse 4, let us build ourselves a city and a tower and make a name and so forth. And it says very specifically in the end of verse 4, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. Exactly opposite of what God wanted. Now, I want to, maybe we could just suffice it, we should insert it, because we need to be able to understand, why did God want mankind to spread out and populate the earth? Does God just have a particularly, does he not like urban dwellers? Should we all sell our house in the suburbs or the city and move out into the country or out on the farm? Well, part of what he's wanting to do, he's wanting to make sure that this population that is now growing will spread out, first of all, for its own good, for several reasons. You understand that the resources that we have, that has developed modern technology and the modern way of life that we live, those resources are not all in one place. We who live here in West Virginia, we have some great resources. For years, we've been, coal has been a big production in the coal fields of West Virginia. Natural gas is one that's been used. Lumber at one particular time. The chemical industry that developed in this valley. Those don't just exist everywhere. So God wanted to, as we continue to move out and find the resources, whatever was available in a particular locality, we could use them for the betterment of mankind. So part of it was just to use the resources. But there's also some other ones. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But secondly, it was God's will for man to follow him. There's something about stepping into territory you haven't been before that causes you to trust God. There's a bit of risk about going into the frontier, so to speak. And you think about what we know from history about the frontiersmen that first came over the mountains from the East Coast and came into what was the wilderness of this part of then Virginia, and now, of course, West Virginia. And then the Ohio Valley and the plains and the West and all of those sort of things. Great risk. There's just something about that God wanted, I think he wanted man to enjoy that adventure of taming this wilderness that was sort of reborn after the flood. And there's something about, he says, there's something inherent about trust in moving forward and that sort of thing. And thirdly, it was God's will was to slow down human rebellion. I don't think we need to all sell our houses right now, okay? But there is something about cities that is different than living in an agricultural setting. Now, I don't know where you grew up, and we have a great variety. I grew up in a very small town. The town I grew up here in West Virginia had a grand total, the entire town, of 800 people, and our entire county had 4,000 in it. Okay, so I grew up in the least populated county in West Virginia. That's where I grew up. So it was small. But there's some advantages of that kind of country, Smallville kind of thing. And we were sharing just a little bit ago as we were talking here in the front that since Wirt County became a county, and of course it was part of another county back when we were all Virginia, but the entire history of Wirt County, there's been 2 murder trials in our county in its entire history. By the way, both of them ended in acquittals for the person that was charged with murder. Both of them ended by a defense of self-defense, okay? Now, how many murder trials has there been in Kanawha County? A few more than 2. And I don't say this is a bad place to live, but you have more people together living in an urban environment. There is more potential. There's more anonymity. There's less accountability. There's a greater ability to transact sin. Can we say it that way? And one of the things, and sometimes, you know, if you're a little older than me, maybe a generation before me, we look at our country and say, what has happened to this country in its morals and its fabric? Well, lots of things have happened. And you can't just say, this thing here caused all of it. But there's one factor you need to factor in there. And it really, when this, and really it was in the mid part, it really was right after, during, and right after World War II, where we took a great step from being agricultural to being industrial. And really, World War II was a major instrument in changing. I mean, even like my dad, who is of that generation, when he was in high school, summers, he went up to Akron and worked in the, you know, building airplanes as a 15, 16-year-old, you know. If the war hadn't been on, I don't know when he would have ever been to that kind of a setting. But that changed everything. That did change, in some sense, the moral fiber because we became more urban. So God, in some sense, by spreading people out, wanted to slow down what he knew was an inevitable move toward sin. And it just seems like in urban settings, there just seems to be, and you know, and Charleston's a pretty great place to live. I mean, we're a small, mid-sized town. We're the biggest city in West Virginia, but by most state standards, still fairly small. And we have it better than most. I was talking to a friend of mine. Actually, they were here in church this morning. We had Christmas this weekend at our house. All of our kids, this was the weekend they all were able to come in because they were all with their in-laws actually on Christmas. So we actually had Christmas last night. But we had a couple and their 17-year-old son that had been friends of ours for years and been kind of like surrogate parents for our children and just a great spiritual influence. So they came for the weekend. I was talking to my friend Joe, and he said he had to go for training for his work to Las Vegas. Now, if you vacation in Las Vegas every year, maybe you ought to think of somewhere else to vacation. I don't know. But I suppose you can go there and be wholesome. But he said we had to go there. He said we were there less than 24 hours, and I looked at my wife, and she looked at me, and we both said to each other, if we never come back here again, we could both die very happy. And I said, what was it? He said, the whole city is just designed to make it really easy to sin, any sin you want to sin. It's just easy. It's available. It's a lot more open than it is where you and I live. Now, it doesn't mean if you've been to Las Vegas, you're necessarily the biggest sinner in the world, but it's just, it has that nature about it. So there's something about spreading people out. God wanted, this was for man's benefit, both technologically and morally. But what you have here was this group of people, and verse 4 is the key. Come, let us build ourselves a city. We're going to stay here, and we're going to unite our forces and unite our purpose and our endeavor, and we're going to do something big. We're going to do something great. And we usually focus on the tower, as well we should, because it's mentioned here. So let's just deal with this tower. Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Now, different translations translate that different ways. I remember when I was a child looking at a Bible storybook, you know, all those storybooks that had all the paintings, and I could still see the painting, you know, all the Tower of Babel going up and kind of disappearing into the clouds, this big thing. And the thought was, well, these people, this is how the storybook told us, thought that they could start, if they built this tower tall enough, that you could walk up the tower and keep going up the tower and going up the tower. And when you got to the top story of the tower, you could just step off and I'm in heaven now. It was like, quote unquote, the stairway to heaven. I would suggest to you that probably the people in Babel were smart enough to know that they couldn't accomplish that. It probably wasn't the passageway to heaven, but in some sort of a pagan religion way whose top was to the heavens. This is how we worship heaven. And one of the things you find from that part of the world, you see this in Daniel, when Daniel and the other Israelites are transported to the kingdom of Babylon during that captivity, that their worship and their system was very pagan and very superstitious. They believed in, they followed the stars and the signs and all those sorts of things and all that stuff that God condemns. So this was probably a place where they worshiped the sun, and they worshiped the moon, and they worshiped the motions of the stars. And we have created a religion that is a rival of faith in God. By the way, the first organized religious thing you see in Scripture, where people, rather than, before the flood, people were just killing each other in rebellion, apparently. But after the flood, it was the first organized rebellion against God in the form of a rival religion of some type. So the tower had some sort of a worship in worshiping the gods rather than the one true God characteristic about it. But the key to understand it is really this phrase in verse 4, let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the earth. We don't want to dilute our combined resources. We don't want to dilute our combined abilities and opportunities. Let's work together, and we're going to make ourselves a name. It was unbridled, selfish, prideful ambition. In essence, they were saying, by the way, we don't need God anymore. We will make a rival religion. We will stay together, and through our efforts, we will do what we want to do. There's one other danger that occurs with this gathering and unification that's taking place at this particular juncture, and that is this. Most human organizations, whether it be a city-state, a country, a business, or any kind of organization, there is a tendency to create a hierarchical bureaucracy out of it. And by that I mean there is ways of controlling people and controlling society, and as you go up to greater levels of authority, there's fewer people. It's kind of like a pyramid. There's fewer people up at the top. And the problem with that is, and this is something else God wanted to do by spreading people out. If you had fewer people at the top controlling many people at the bottom, think of what advantage this is for Satan. All we have to do is get a few people corrupted at the top, and that will influence an inordinate amount of people at the bottom of the hierarchy chain, if you want to say it that way. By the way, this is slightly off the subject. Most of us in the church world who embrace the independency of a local church, and by that I mean not being part of a big denomination or a big group. In many of the quote denominations, you have some small group in power, a bishop or whatever the group is, and they tell the local churches down here in the very other cities what to do and who their pastor is and where to send their money, all those sorts of things. We tend to believe in the autonomy and the specialness of the local church. Why? Partly is, and this has happened literally in some of the big denominations that used to at least preach the gospel. Why? Because it got corrupted at the top. With a few people who've abandoned truth in the God, and they control the schools and the seminaries and the money and the organization, and the people sitting in the pews have lost control of their own worship center. It really is true. And that's why I really like being a church where it's just us. It doesn't mean we don't love other people. It doesn't mean we can't work with other people that love the Lord, or maybe it's a mission board or whatever. We understand that. But we are personally responsible to each other before God to honor His word. It really lessens it doesn't mean we can't goof up, mess up, but it's a less potential for quick corruption. That's part of what this spreading out needs to do. So he wanted to slow down human rebellion. Now you go back to chapter 11, verse 1. He puts this one key ingredient in here. Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. That makes sense because when Adam and Eve were created, they could communicate with each other. They could communicate with God. Obviously, they had a conversation with the serpent. And from one central source, you would expect, if you didn't know anything else, you would just expect that everybody would speak the same language. Now, the skeptics would tell us, the people whose basic approach to this is all myth and not true anyway, say that statement in chapter 11, verse 1 is just totally ridiculous. Man never, ever had just one central language. But it's interesting, and I'm not an expert on linguistics by any stretch of the imagination, but every time I have tried to read what the quote experts tell us about where all these languages, because there's a whole bunch of them, right? Just go to any major city and hang out in the airport, and you'll hear languages from all over the world. Go to any major city, it's amazing. Right here in America, you know, the whole world is around, and if you travel anywhere outside the world, you understand. When God did what He did by confusing the languages, He did a very good job of it. He did an extremely good job of it. But to hear the theories apart from the Bible about where all these divergent languages come from, My eyes just glaze over after a while because it gets so convoluted, and maybe you've seen them, these great, it looks like an upside down tree with all these branches and stuff going on. And maybe people are really smart, but I think it's just a lot easier just to open it up to chapter 11 of Genesis and take God's word on it. He just did what he did. And by the way, I really don't think, as best I can understand, there really isn't a satisfactory theory that really holds together. And this one certainly does, because God has revealed it. But there was one language and one speech, and God uses that to his advantage in what he's going to take place. Now, let's talk about the spiritual lessons. The spiritual lessons, all right? There's four of them, and it's very important, and most of them come from verses 4, 5, and 6. But number one, and I'm gonna use this as the we, because I want to include us here, all right? We tend to overestimate human knowledge and strength. We're going to build us a city. We're going to do what we want. Our ambition is going to drive us. We're not going to scatter out. We're going to do what we want to do. And they did until God showed up. The natural tendency of man, this is the natural tendency of you, it's the natural tendency of me, is to overestimate human knowledge and strength. I just say that to say this, always be on your guard. When you take any measure of human strength, human ability, your knowledge, your strength, because you're not as smart and you're not as strong as you think you are, and neither am I. I read the other day, you know, the end of the year is always an interesting time, and the beginning of a new year. We have all that, we review all of last year, and then we tell all the things that are going to be happening this year. And I read this article about all the medical advances that are expected to happen this year. And if you just believe the article, none of us are going to be sick by December, all right? Everything's going to be fixed. We're going to fix your heart. We're going to fix your diseases. We're going to cure cancer. We're right on the edge of just everything being fixed. Now, I've only lived on this planet 51 years, but you know what I have observed? Whenever we cure one disease, it seems like there's three more that I've never heard of have popped up. When we find some way to treat some condition, there's three different ones that show up. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try to treat diseases. We shouldn't try to take care of our body. We shouldn't use the medical arts. That's part of the knowledge that's given. But here's what I'm saying. We are never going to accomplish all that we say we're going to accomplish, because there is a fundamental reality embedded into the human condition, and that is we are under the curse of sin, and we are fallen people. People, you know, this side of heaven are always going to be dying. There's going to be sickness. There's going to be difficulty. There's going to be those kind of issues. So it was an interesting reminder to me to hear someone in this article say, we're going to just conquer everything. Watch it. We overestimate human knowledge and human strength. So whenever you get in that stage, or you hear someone else, just what you want to do is just kind of like divide it by about 75%, and that's really where we are. And maybe we needed to go do further than that. We are not as smart as we think we are. We are definitely not as strong as we think we are. And when they say, we're going to build us a city, we're going to build us a tower, we're going to make a name, we're not going to be scattered. We are not going to be scattered over the face of the earth. The only thing that happened after this project was they were forced to be scattered over the face of the earth. God saw to it that they were. Number two, we tend to underestimate God's knowledge and strength. We tend to underestimate God's knowledge and strength. Verse 4, they said what we're going to do, and then verse 5. I love verse 5. But God came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of man had built. Isn't that interesting language? It's as if he couches in the language of, I'm going to come down and take a stroll. I'm going to take an inspection tour of this bride. I'm going to come look at this tower. I'm going to walk through the streets of the city. That's kind of the picture, the picture language that's used. Now, God knew everything. He didn't have to pay to visit, but it just helps us understand that God just kind of took a good look at everything. And by the way, have you figured this out? God knows everything. You have never thought a thought. There's no such thing as a private thought before God. There's no such thing as a secret word. There's no such thing as a hidden ambition or a hidden motive. Louis Spiro Schaefer said years ago, one of my favorite quotes of him, he says, there might be such a thing as a secret sin on earth, but it is always open scandal in heaven. Think about that. What does mankind think? We can just do whatever we want. We can get away with anything and everything. No one will ever know. Well, other people may not know, but God knows full well. He shows up. They underestimated God's knowledge, and secondly, they underestimated God's strength. Verse 6, and the Lord said, indeed, the people are one and have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now, nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. They had an advantage that God is about to take away from them. Think for a moment. It's hard for us to imagine, but if everybody in the whole world had the same language, it would simplify a lot of things. I mean, I have enough time trying to convert things from metrics to English. You know, I was reading about one of those ziggurats up there that I looked up. It was 31 kilometers from Baghdad. I'm sorry, 31 kilometers means nothing to me. I've got to now convert this to miles, and it's all confused. But now, when it comes to language, it's even more convoluted. It greatly complicates human interaction worldwide. God designed it that way. God designed it that way. And mankind has created great things to try to overcome. You can, there's one of the ones that came out in the 10 years or so ago as a website, Alta Vista has it. It's called Babelfish, where you can type in a web page and pick the language, and then it'll display the web page in the language that you pick. If you want to, I remember I was trying to translate a page into German one time. It's a long story why I was doing that, but I was doing it for someone, and then I had a guy that I corresponded by email with who was German. So I said, I'm going to send you this page, and I want to see how well you did it. He wrote back, ha, ha, ha. And he underlined all the sections where it was not a very good translation. It's just kind of a word for word wooden thing. But there's all kinds of computers that do that and that sort of thing, and it helps. But God just interrupted what they were doing. Now you think about this. He says, I'm going to come, let us go down, verse 7, and confuse their language that they may not understand one another's speech. And all it says, so the Lord scattered them abroad. Now, we have to supply some imagination there. I don't know how far they were on the city, how far along they were on the tower. I kind of think God waited till they were just about where they were getting real excited about opening day. I kind of think they had the ribbon cutting already planned. It's just me thinking. But I think he let them go far enough that they just really got puffed up with pride. Because you just kind of get a sense from Scripture, when God wants to bring someone's pride down, he somehow picks the exact perfect moment to do it. Remember we did the Dumb Moves series we did last fall? You find the people like Mordecai or some of the others, God just picked the right moment and bam. So I kind of think it was the right moment. But just think for a moment. When God confused the language, even though maybe you are now suddenly zapped speaking a language and understanding a language you've never spoken before, you just think everybody else speaks that same language. I think it was undetectable when the change took place. So, okay, get up, go to work in the morning. I grab my hard hat and my lunch bucket, and I go down to where they're mixing and baking the bricks, and we're gonna put the last few blocks in the city, in the tower, and suddenly you get there, and this guy is unintelligible. I can't understand what he's saying. Now, and you ask for a question, and you're unintelligible to him. Can you imagine? That was a really bad day at work. Suddenly, we can't talk to anybody. And then you search around, and maybe you find a little pocket. We found three of us that seem to be able to communicate. And that little pocket over there, they seem to be able to communicate. And there's four or five over there could be able to communicate, but we can't communicate with either. It just suddenly, just by God stirring up the language pot, suddenly, the whole project was total chaos. You can't communicate. You're not going to... You ever notice how hard it is to build something when you speak the same language? Right? Have you ever remodeled your house? Just you and your wife and whoever's doing the work? Especially if you're doing the work, how complicated that gets. My wife and I do it with collars. We do not agree on anything. We speak different languages when it comes to collars. She claims I'm collarblind. But I see lots of collars. I just see them completely different than she does. That's all. But it's hard enough to communicate, but suddenly now the whole project falls into chaos, and they have to segregate by language to be able to do anything. I got to hang around the people I could at least communicate with. So it was forced segregation of people groups. And God is just showing how strong he is, his knowledge and his strength. Let me just insert this right now, and we'll come back to the last two of these, what we're going to call spiritual lessons from Babel. But there's a couple things that this does for us. First of all, it explains why there's all the languages in the world. It explains the way it is. There's something else that takes place significant here. And I told you I'm not a linguist. I'm neither am I a geneticist. But in layman's terms, if you take any reproducing group of organisms and you forcibly segregate them into smaller groups, it is going to change the characteristics of that group of organisms. Have you ever wondered why we as a race of humanity look different? Evolutionists have a whole scheme about these sort of things. In fact, there was a day, and this is kind of covered up by the evolutionist, that Darwin and some of these guys taught that, well, the people of this racial group, they haven't developed as much as, and of course, you know, we white Europeans were the top of the pile, supposedly, because the people doing the research and the writing were white people of European descent. And of course, you always put yourself at the top of the pyramid, so that's how it was. And, you know, the Aborigines of Australia, or the people that came from Africa or Asia, or the Native Americans or whatever, and it was extreme racism propelled by this evolutionary thought. But you and I have to recognize, excuse me, even though I do not like the term race, because there's only one race of humanity, and that's the human race. We all descended from Adam and Eve, and it narrowed down through Noah's family and spread out again. So the racial barriers is very artificial. But people look different, have different characteristics, different abilities, different talents. Why has that happened? It really can be explained from Genesis chapter 11. God separated the humanity into language groups. It narrowed the gene pool of each group and probably then led to geographic segregation. Whenever that happens, it changes the characteristics coming out of that gene pool. Creation scientists that I've read, and like I said, I'm not a geneticist, but I've heard that it said that within 5 or 6 or 10 generations, what we call racial characteristics could have already started to develop in certain geographic locations because of the limiting of the gene pool. It's just a natural result of God segregating people at the Tower of Babel and segregating them because they had to now spread out into certain geographic locations. So, very, very key to understand life as it is now. Number three. Third spiritual lesson. We tend to steal God's glory for ourselves. That's the bottom line of how human beings operate. God says, I am the Creator. You follow me. I want to bless you. I want to be with you. And mankind says, nope, I want to be top of the pile. You see it right here in the Tower of Babel story. And fourthly, we see this very clearly. We just talked about it. We will pay the price when we fail to give God the glory. They paid a price. The tower stood there until it succumbed and crumbled by the years and the decay of time passing. And now it's just a story. We do see some ruins that seem similar, but this actual place, we really don't know exactly where it was or what remains it was. God will intervene because God will see that if we just continue in rebellion, there is a guaranteed price to be paid. You do not escape. We cannot escape. We will never escape. And let me just say this to all of us, and I don't know any of our hearts and where we are, but if you have ever for a moment or in some little area of life thinking, I could get away with this and no one will ever know because I'm going to go my own way, in that particular area, you're on shaky ground. And God will not mind his own business when it comes to his glory and following him. What are the life lessons? What are the life lessons from Babel? There's just two of them. I want to leave you with these. Number one, we always need to determine who is the influencer in your life. Who is the influencer in your life? Who am I listening to? What's leading me along? What motivates me? If it's human pride or if it's collective, peer pressure generated human pride, we're in trouble. Who's my heroes? Who influences me? Who am I trying to please? Who am I trying to impress? What am I trying to accomplish? We need to allow God access to that level of our hearts. David prayed this way, "Search me, O God. Know me. Try me. See if there be any wicked way in me." We need to insert that into our prayer life. Lord, take a good look. Root it out if you find it in me. Because this is how we should live. Determined to make God the influencer in your life. Lord, I want you to propel me. I want you to motivate me. I want you to thrill me. I want to make my life about you. By the way, A, it just works better. And number two, that's what God, really it should be number one, but that's what God is pleased with. That's what God expects. Need to be influenced. And we only have that influence by living in accordance with this word, as we talked about this morning, living in community with other believers, of just seeking to order our lives and make a big deal out of Jesus in our life. The story ends with these words. Verse 8. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over all the face of the earth. What God said they would do, and they said they wouldn't, is exactly what they wound up doing, because God intervened. And they ceased building the city. The city, the tower, the name they wanted, just swept into the dustbin of history. Therefore, its name is called Babel. Its name is called Confusion, because the Lord there confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over all the face of the earth. They were a people, we said at the beginning, of unbridled human ambition. I'm just going to give you this last statement, and may the Lord just let this kind of just continue to resonate and reverberate in our hearts. Do this. Make His ambition yours.